Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from Pillar 2 to U.S. politics. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. The Pillar 2 engine from PwC is a game changer for Pillar 2 modeling, provision, and compliance calculations. Built on a graph system utilizing over 20 years of international tax technology, this centralized rules engine is built by a team of Pillar 2 tax experts from around the globe. PwC's Pillar 2 engine is currently available as a service and will be licensable in July 2024. On this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks, we're back at PwC's International Tax Conference in Dana Point, California, where I'm excited to have Chairman Dave Camp back on the podcast. Chairman Camp is a senior policy advisor for PwC's Washington National Tax Practice. He served as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives from 1991 to 2015 and was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee from 2011 to 2015. Chairman Camp, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, so the last time you were on, Chairman Camp, we were in the throes of the pandemic. We had to do a virtual, which I just hated doing, because it's just really hard not sitting in front and being able to have the conversation. But I'm glad to finally have you back on live here in the flesh.
It's good to have that in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. All right, so in 1988, and we're going to flash you back to your career because I've got a lot of questions for you. In 1988, you ran for the Michigan House of Representatives. 2 years later, you ran for U.S. Congress and served for almost 25 years in the House. Let me start with this question. Why in the heck did you go into politics?
Well, you know, I was a lawyer in a small town, and I was asked to rewrite everybody's bylaws and, you know, be a volunteer on boards and things. And so you sort of learn about the needs of a community when you're a volunteer as well. And in small towns, it's really easy to get involved. And so that was kind of the start of it. And then I had clients that would have a zoning issue. And I'd be like, well, why do they get to decide that? And how did that rule get written? And obviously in a law firm, you're reading the state laws.
Sure.
So it was kind of a natural. And I helped other candidates run for office. So I really started as a volunteer, both, you know, for nonprofits as well as a volunteer helping other people get elected for office. So I kind of saw the process close up. And I remember going to my first state convention. I hated it. But then I went to a second one and I kind of saw the dynamics going on and sort of became interested in issues. But what really got me going was one of my senior partners ran for judge. And I was a lowly associate in the firm,
okay.
And he said, your job is to put my yard signs all over the county. So I, you know.
Did you get billable hours for that?
I did not get billable
right.
hours, but I pleased the senior partner.
All right, that's important.
Helpful. Yeah,
that's
it was
important.
Very helpful. So I kind of enjoyed that dynamics of the campaign and getting the yard signs in people's yards. So I sort of got backed into it, really.
Did you anticipate you'd have a 25-year career
no.
in the House?
I wasn't one of these people that knew at 10 years old I wanted to be in elective office.
Okay.
I did back into it. And so being in the state legislature allowed me to still practice law. So on Fridays, I'd come back and do legal work and see clients. But when you go to Congress, you have to give all that up. You can't practice law and be in Congress at the same time.
So what advice, based on your experiences, would you have for somebody that's thinking about going into politics? And would you advise one of your kids, for example, to get in, given the current climate that we have today?
Yeah, it depends on what motivates you. So you'd have to look inside and say, is this something I want to do? Am I interested in policy? Am I interested in elective office? What is it? And there's lots of ways to contribute. But I would suggest to people, try volunteering for somebody. Whether it's a city council or a nonpartisan race for judge, like I did my first race I kind of volunteered for. Do that and see whether it's something you're interested in. Are there issues that motivate you? Do you care about, you know, having someone else serve in an elective office? And that way you can kind of get a taste of it and see. I always followed current events, so I think if I look back when I was mm-hmm. a kid, I was always interested in current events, and I think maybe that was sort of the beginning of my interest in ultimately being a public servant.
All right, well, we're going to fast forward now to 2010. So you were one of three House Republicans appointed by then Minority Leader John Boehner, Republican from Ohio, to serve on the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, known as the Bowles-Simpson Commission. Tell us a little bit of what was that and what did you learn from that experience?
Well, it was a presidential commission that was really to look at our debt and the unsustainability of it, and then what path forward could we have on that. So there were a number of people from Senate, House, some private sector folks on this committee as well, and Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles, who former chief of staff to President Clinton, they were the chairs of it, and we had a number of meetings and really explored ways to try to address our fiscal problems. And ultimately, there was a report written. It was a report I didn't support because of some of the dynamics there, but what they did was ultimately increase the share of revenue to the government significantly in order to address our fiscal situation, rather than looking at how do we adjust and reduce some spending. So it was really something that was really meant to come up with a number of recommendations. It was something the president did not follow. President Obama did not follow ultimately, but it was a tremendous exercise. And
I'm sure.
Actually, I got to know a number of senators that were really helpful as I continue to work on tax reform. So, you know, you get on some of these things and build relationships that really help as you get into other issues going forward.
So how did that experience and sort of learning and diving deep into fiscal responsibility really shape your views on tax policy? Because you were appointed House Ways and Means Chair that following year.
Well, I knew that from having been on the committee for 16 years before I became chairman, or as ranking member first and then chairman, I knew that we weren't competitive as a country, that our tax system was really out of step with the rest of the world, both in terms of our statutory and effective corporate rates, as well as the system we had. Mm-hmm. So the worldwide system. So
sure.
I knew that we needed to do some things there. But I also felt that tax policy could encourage investment. And I thought investment was the key to continuing to grow our economy, so that businesses would be productive, that they would hire people and provide for those families and also help build the communities those families live in. So I knew that that was important and something that I really wanted to work on.
Good. We're going to come back to a number of those topics, but sort of sticking with general fiscal policy before we get into some of the tax stuff, what concerns do you have about the current U.S. debt levels and overall fiscal position in the U.S., particularly given your background?
Well, I mean, even back then, they were saying our debt levels were unsustainable, and of course, they far exceeded that now.
Right.
So the question is, when is it a tipping point? And I guess looking at what's happened around the world in other countries, say in the UK, there is ultimately a tipping point at some point. And so my view is always you want to be prepared before you reach that point.
Right.
And I always felt like there could be a plan or a process where you'd begin to sort of ratchet down the debt. Much like a home mortgage, where
right.
you start to make payments and address it. But I always thought that was something that we should do. But you know, there just really isn't the political will, and particularly leaders of either party right now are not interested in addressing that issue. And the public isn't really engaged in it either. Now, there were times, particularly in the 90s, when the public was somewhat engaged in doing something about our debt and deficit. So until the public is really reacting again to that. And I always felt like when interest on the debt became sort of equivalent to defense spending,
mm-hmm.
that there was, which is about half the discretionary side of the budget, defense, that there would be some sort of groundswell to push that. We're really at that point now, and yet we aren't really seeing the public really kind of weighing in, feeling that this is something that must be done right away. Although opinion leaders are.
Sure.
And financial experts and others are saying a lot, but it isn't really coming from the public yet.
Is there a particular piece of tax policy that could really help? And I guess specifically, it is a VAT, because we are one of the few developed countries without a national sales tax. And in my global role, I travel around and, you know, obviously focusing on corporate tax, but people are always shocked, I think, and forget that, yeah, we've got state sales taxes, but not really a national sales tax. I mean, is that the one of or a key piece of the potential answer?
Well, I always thought growth, economic growth was, because as we've seen with the TCJA, revenues to the government have increased in far, you know, exceeding what was projected under that legislation. So I always felt that growth was a piece of it, but not you just can't grow your way out of this completely. So you know, I thought that was always a very important part of it.
All right. So we're going to fast forward now to you were the House Ways and Means Committee Chairman, as you mentioned, from 2011 to 2015 during the Obama administration. And
yes.
To remind listeners, you are a Republican.
Yes.
Can you tell us about how bipartisanship worked for tax policy at that time? And then I'm going to ask you to compare that to the current environment in Washington.
Well, I was chairman in the House, and the Senate Finance Chairman was Senator Baucus, who was a Democrat. And he actually came to me at the beginning and said, we need to meet every week. And I thought, you know, I don't have time for this. I can't believe that. And we actually did meet every week. And wow. Through that process, we got to know each other. And we actually became friends by the end of this. But we were both trying to work on tax policy at the same time. We had the first joint hearing on tax between the House and Senate in, you know, 50 years. So we did try to do that. I also tried to incorporate bipartisan policies because I knew that there was a Democratic president and a democratically controlled Senate, that a Republican-only bill would not go anywhere. So I was really trying to advance something that might ultimately get to the finish line. So that was really an important strategy. I created bipartisan working groups in the House, in the Ways and Means Committee, to sort of segment and take various tax issues. So we had a Republican and Democrat on each one of those, and they had hearings, they met with stakeholders, and that was really helpful to develop some of the issues. And when I did introduce the bill, I know this is a very small point, but
yeah.
It really wasn't criticized heavily by Democrats because they knew some of their policies were in it. They didn't necessarily embrace it, but they didn't really criticize it. And it did ultimately become a large framework for what became law in the TCJA in 2017.
Yeah, remind listeners, what were some of those key international tax components of the bill that you introduced?
Well, the big thing that really united everyone was the rate.
Sure.
And, you know, we wanted to move away from the worldwide system, which, you know, the bill did. And so lowering corporate rate, you know, repatriating dollars that were trapped overseas. I mean, those were some of the key points. And, you know, really moving out of that kind of worldwide system of taxation, which the U.S. had been in, and really almost alone in that kind of a system.
So if you compare the current situation, we have a Democratic president, we've got a Democratic-controlled Senate, Republican House, so very similar to the situation that you just described. Do you see, from you talking to your former colleagues, I mean, there's just so much polarization, but I don't really see behind the scenes. Is there still that bipartisanship amongst members, or, you know, what is your view on the current state of play, particularly from a partisanship perspective? Because from my perspective, not somebody from the inside, it seems like a lot of partisanship and not really some of that interaction that you described.
Yeah, I think this recent sort of extenders tax bill that passed the committee in a bipartisan way and passed the House in an overwhelmingly bipartisan way. It's still not through the Senate yet, but shows to me there still is a path there. I, you know, watched part of that hearing. I thought it was a very civil discussion. Clearly, there's disagreements on how to move forward. I think it'll be interesting. First of all, when you have sort of a successful bill like that, you build relationships between the staffs, between the members, and they've found they can work together and develop a work product. So I think it'll be interesting to see once this bill kind of gets through the Senate, which I'm still optimistic it will, that what will be the path forward that the chairman of the committee, of the Ways and Means Committee, takes. He has mentioned in public that he would like to do some working groups. And if he sort of starts out on that process, and there are only five Republicans that were on the committee when the TCJA was passed. So there's a lot of education, and there's so much background to these issues, as you know.
Sure.
You need to know kind of what went on before and why it was changed and how we got to where we are now before you can really make another change in tax policy. So they've got a lot of work to do. But I think this recent extenders tax bill where they sort of brokered a compromise between extending certain business provisions, paired with the CTC. But the issue, I think, facing them is the scope, breadth, and complexity of the number of expiring provisions, although sometimes a larger bill is easier to get consensus on than a smaller bill because there are more moving parts that you can work on that will bring support.
Sure. So let's move to that. So there are 33 individual tax provisions from the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that will be changed or expiring at the end of 2025. As well as a number of corporate provisions, including GILTI and FDII and the BEAT rates. I want to start maybe looking back and then want to spend a little bit more time looking forward. Looking back, how have the international provisions from the TCJA worked, in your view?
Well, there's a lot of complexity there. And of course, you now have to look at the TCJA also with the backdrop of what's happening at the OECD and internationally and what other countries are doing.
I've got some questions on that one.
You can't just, you know, kind of look at this in a vacuum. And then, of course, we have to look at this since TCJA was passed. CAMPT has been overlaid on this as well. So this kind of book minimum tax issue. I think it has certainly, the bill in general has resulted in, you know, a lot of economic growth, you know, certainly more revenue to the government than was expected, more investment back in the United States, you know, IP is coming back to the U.S. So I think all in all, it was a successful piece of legislation. Those provisions, you know, kind of, as I say, tax policy is all kind of connected. And so if you kind of pull one thread, you've got to also look at pulling other threads. So I think they have to be looked at in the context of these international changes, but also in the context of our debt situation now. The cost of extending a lot of these provisions is in the trillions. And will they have the ability to do that, given the emphasis on spending and debt that a large portion of the Republican conference is interested in? How will you do that? And of course, as we know, in the TCJA, they had $1.5 trillion in deficit spending, largely funding the individual tax provisions.
Right.
So what will be that dynamic going forward? So there's a lot of difficult issues they have to think about and address.
Yeah, I will tell you, as an observer, as an advisor working with a lot of, you know, major U.S. multinationals and taxpayers, I think that, you know, obviously changing the kind of the worldwide system, which I intellectually have a hard time calling it a worldwide system, but the fact that that income was deferred from U.S. tax until it was brought back, which really encouraged companies to keep that cash offshore, that has certainly changed the view of treasurers and U.S. multinationals to bring that cash back to the U.S. And then obviously the FDII, to your point, on really sort of stopping the tax incentive, arguably, to be able to move IP back. And I think it really allows companies to focus on, well, where do they have the significant people functions? And, you know, oftentimes that's in the U.S. And so that has certainly driven a lot of behavior to bring that IP back to the U.S.
Well, as I mentioned, rate was a critical part of the reform movement. But also what we had were these inversions. And the inversions were occurring because of our rate.
Right.
And since TCJA, there have been none. But the concern was, and this was actually also articulated in a bipartisan way in the Senate, because the Senate had some working groups, and the one on international, they found that if, in fact, the headquarters of a U.S. company ends up being in another country because, you know, the minnow swallows the whale and the
right.
headquarters is overseas, eventually you're going to have people there as well.
Right.
They have substance. So that was really a concern, both in a bipartisan way, and the repatriation was also a significant factor in getting all this done. So I think those things all did work from that standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. And just to remind listeners, this concept of an inversion was the idea where a U.S. parented company would become some other foreign parented company. And to the minnow swallowing the whale point, there were companies that were doing deals where they were acquiring a relatively small target. But if that small target was foreign parented, they were effectively reorganizing themselves to have a foreign parented company. And I think the concern is a valid one, is that to be able to manage that substance with a foreign parented company, that means those executives are going to be moving or spending time.
And, you know, I live in a small town with a big company. And whenever the hospital needs funds or there's a United Way campaign, they go to the employees at the headquarters of
that
company. And so when you lose a headquartered company, you lose this incredible, you know, not just those salaried positions, but what those salaried positions contribute to the community in terms of not only charitable work and all of that, but the restaurants, the hospital, the schools, it all gets related. So when, you know, when people go to the Hill and talk about tax policy, they also need to sort of connect it to what it means, not just for jobs, but how those jobs impact communities.
Yeah. And I mean, I see this from my travels around the globe and how tax policies have really, you know, changed economies. I mean, Singapore is a great example of pro-corporate tax policies, and, you know, how it's transformed that entire city and island is absolutely amazing.
Ireland,
another great example. So, and we're gonna come back to a couple of those topics, but I want to look forward now from a U.S. tax policy perspective, given these expiring provisions with the TCJA. What are your views on the prospects for significant U.S. tax reform in 2025 or 2026?
Well, some of this will depend on who wins the election, of course. And the question is, will we have unified government? And that, in that case, you might have a reconciliation bill, potentially. So there could be some significant changes under that scenario. Or if we have divided government, there will not be a reconciliation bill, which allows a bill to pass the Senate with a simple majority.
Right.
So if it's divided government, it will have to be a compromise piece. So in sort of a micro way, this bipartisan tax bill that we're waiting to hopefully pass the Senate is kind of a path forward. But I could see with the scope and scale of this potentially maybe an extension for a couple of years and not a full 10-year bill because of the cost. And the question is, because this bipartisan bill was offset really for the first time, an extender package, how much of this bill will be offset? And that remains to be determined. So there's a lot of factors that we don't know yet. Who's really in charge, you know, what their policies will be. I mean, President Trump has been campaigning on a 15% corporate rate.
Right.
President Biden would like to see a higher corporate rate than current law. So in order to pay for the individual piece, will they deficit spend, or will there be, will they look to the business side, to the corporate side, in order to be able to do some of these individual provisions, which are the more expensive pieces of a renewal bill? So we have to see, kind of, are they going to begin work this summer and kind of fleshing some of this out? If they do, I mean, we thought that 2024 would be kind of a planning year on this, but 2024 is moving along, and where they're kind of tied up with budget issues and appropriations, government funding. So the question is, what will they be able to do this year to get them ready in 2025? But not much in terms of legislation or is going to happen between now and the election.
Sure.
But this is where you could be doing a lot of committee work that might not get much notice other than those of us who are really following this stuff carefully.
Yeah.
And we have yet to see that happening. Although there is a hearing this week in Ways and Means on Pillar One. So that's kind of a beginning to sort of move things forward. But I think that's because there was a JCT score that was recently released.
So you mentioned reconciliation, and I'm hesitant to go down this rabbit hole, but I would like to get your views on this. And this is also, you know, we've got a lot of listeners outside the U.S., and as I travel around, I get a lot of questions about this reconciliation process. And really, the reason, right, that we have these expiring provisions is that if you do not have 60 votes in the Senate of the 100 senators, you have to go through this reconciliation process. And steer me where I go wrong here, but generally it requires any of that legislation to be revenue neutral over a 10-year period, which means that as the legislation is crafted, there has to sometimes be expiring provisions. And what is your views on reconciliation? And it's a real challenge for tax policy, right? Because we have some of these great policies that spur investment, but that just time out because of reconciliation.
Well, it was really designed as a budget or a mechanism to really help with our debt and deficit. But it's been used as a policy provision both for the Affordable Care Act, for the TCJA. And so, though, the Biden administration has used it as well. And it requires a budget to pass the House and Senate, the same thing. And so unless you have the House and Senate in the same party and the president willing to deal with that, you're not going to be able to be in reconciliation. But it means that you can't increase the deficit outside this 10-year budget window because it was a budget mechanism. And the second piece is you cannot legislate on the reconciliation bill. And that means, for example, the minimum wage was ruled by a Senate parliamentarian to not be compliant with the rules because it's meant to be a budget process. So the policy in there has to have budget impact. So tax obviously follows the budget impact piece of it. But that's why they have to expire provisions later on. Now, a budget gives them only so much money to spend on tax policy. So some of the expiring provisions on the business side were really to kind of fit within the budget cap that they had in order to prepare this legislation. So that's where some of this.
Yeah, and I think that there's some head scratchers for people that are not familiar with our system about why does this stuff keep expiring? This seems to be working well, and that's the answer.
But it does allow the bill to pass the Senate with just a simple majority, right? Because getting 60 votes, as we're seeing, even on a bipartisan bill that passed the House in a significant way, has been difficult. And right. So it allows a close majority to pass legislation.
All right, so sticking with the prospects of future legislation, any views on, and we'll get to some of the Pillar 2 process, but any speculation or what are your views on the prospects for the U.S. actually implementing Pillar 2?
I don't see it in the short term. The only way that you might see it addressed is if during the TCJA kind of renewal debate, which I think will mainly be in 2025, will there be some accommodation there? But I think there would have to be a greater alignment between the Treasury Department and the Congress on this, because they really aren't aligned. And we'll actually find out, I think, a little bit after this hearing this week on Pillar 1 in the Ways and Means Committee, that I think some Democrats will not be as pleased with the direction the administration's going, not just Republicans. So, that's, I think, something mm-hmm. we're going to have to kind of see. But that's the place where you might try to get some of these. But, you're going to have to get whatever the Congress does, the administration's going to have to negotiate at the OECD level.
Right.
And there hasn't been the greatest communication. And, I've said in the past, with trade, where the trade representatives' authority has been delegated to the administration by Congress, there should be a similar mechanism for international tax, because in international tax, you've got the administration negotiating, but they don't have the authority to implement anything, and yet you've got the House that does have and Senate that does have the authority to implement anything, but it's really up to the administration to deal with foreign governments.
Right.
So you get this really kind of disconnect there, and so they really need to adopt where there's a formal consultation from the administration to the Congress, because both Republicans and Democrats have complained about the lack of consultation mm-hmm. during the OECD project.
Yeah, I want to double click on that. I do want to make one comment with respect to Pillar 2 and the prospects for potential U.S. changes. There was obviously a lot of discussion with the Build Back Better, which was a proposal during the first 2 years of the Biden administration, where they had democratically controlled House, democratically controlled Senate. The Biden administration had been negotiating with the OECD at the kind of onset of Pillar 2. And the idea was, well, if as part of Build Back Better, we could move GILTI to country by country, then that would be close enough to Pillar 2. And, fast forward a few years later now, we have 35 countries that are implementing Pillar 2. And as somebody who is in the weeds on these technical rules, the tax bases, Chairman Camp, are significantly different between U.S. taxable income and the GILTI, and then the Pillar 2 globe income calculations. And I do question now at this point whether just simply modifying GILTI to make it by country as opposed to a blended regime, whether the OECD would view that as a compliant Pillar 2 regime. But maybe the point is that there needs to be negotiation beforehand.
There does, because now companies potentially are facing three different sort of levels of tax base,
right?
Both income, now CAMTI, the book back, and then this globe income issue. And I think one of the things about the TCJA was a simplification, more on the individual side, but
sure.
the business side has become, by a power of three, more complex. And that, I think, is a problem. I think country by country is a real challenge for members of Congress, to at least some, to accept. Mm-hmm. Some are obviously for that, but it's a real challenge, I think, for the business community on that.
Yeah, and the Biden administration, or Treasury, it appears, successfully negotiated with the OECD to effectively defer a subsidiary of a U.S. multinational from collecting the top-up tax under the UTPR yes. to 2026, which I, presume was the thought, well, if we're going to have tax reform with all these expiring provisions, that may be the year that the U.S. would be compliant. But for many of the reasons that you described, if we do not implement Pillar 2, you know, that is an important date where potential subsidiaries of the U.S. will potentially collect the top-up tax. And we'll see what happens with the research and development credit, which is a bad credit, which can tank a company's yes. Pillar 2 rate.
Well, and I mean, the research and development credit is something that has been, you know, in U.S. policy for decades. It's very critical to get the kind of innovation and investment we want to see to continue to be a dynamic, growing economy and all the benefits that flow from that. And the fact that that is not compliant but yet refundable credits are, and I just don't see in the U.S., you know, the federal government writing checks to companies being an acceptable path ahead. So I think that was a real miss, unfortunately, in terms of the negotiation. So what you'll have is cash subsidies. Mm-hmm. So if I don't believe in this race to the bottom on income tax rates, but you will certainly have a race to the top on who can give the most subsidies. And particularly developing countries are not going to have the bandwidth necessarily to do the subsidies that some of the developed countries are. So then yet comes in another fourth player, which is the UN, which is certainly looking at this now, and where do they go? I mean, they're just in the beginning stages of this, so we yet have yet another international body that I think is going to be more in tune with where the developing countries are, and how is that going to impact? So there's, mm-hmm. and I think this issue of tax sovereignty is an important one as well. I mean, how much tax sovereignty is the Congress going to give up? I didn't think they'd give up the kind of control in a book minimum tax, so I was wrong on that, and they did. Because you do now have income being defined to some extent by an outside agency, outside the government. But, you know, what's going to happen as we move forward on this, I think, is going to be important.
Yeah, you mentioned the R&D credit, just a huge policy issue, and that, you know, to your point, I get a lot of questions around this from around the globe. Will the U.S. just do a refundable R&D credit? And, I mean, the fact is we've got a lot of tech companies that fail. And
yeah.
like, we're not, like, the U.S. FISC cannot afford to fund that.
Right.
I
don't see it.
And I just don't see it. And then another big issue, and I think this is a little bit of a sleeper, is the CAMT, as you mentioned, this book minimum tax really, you know, serves as an alternative minimum tax that effectively allows a taxpayer who ends up in this book minimum tax or the CAMT, if they then the following year end up in the regular corporate tax, can then use that as a credit to effectively refund their corporate tax. Well, that AMT credit carry forward, that CAMT credit forward, similar to the R&D credit, is non-refundable. And so if it's a U.S. subsidiary or a foreign parent or after 2026 when the UTPR kicks in, that CAMT credit is similar to the R&D, and that some of those can be big numbers for taxpayers. And,
yes.
you know, as you kind of look back at the, you know, how Pillar 2 has been negotiated, it's really two administrations that have kind of had a seat at the table. You know, the obviously the R&D credit, I feel like, is one glaring kind of policy issue.
Yeah.
This book minimum tax, the CAMT and the AMT credit, that was all introduced after the Pillar 2 framework, which was a little shocking to me that we went with this AMT credit carry forward that could effectively be paid back to a foreign FISC. What are your views on how the process has gone to date? And you had already mentioned that, you know, by effectively enabling or requiring Congress and Treasury to work more closely together. But what are your views kind of looking back and maybe expand on how we can fix this going forward?
Well, I think there might have been this unwritten thing that somehow there were those in particularly this Biden administration that wanted to see these policies enacted. And they felt that if the world moves forward on Pillar 2, business will be forced to go to Congress and say, look, we need help here. I think that's a strategic, if that in fact was a strategy, it's a strategic mistake. Mm-hmm. Because, and one of the things that might help on all of this is where the Joint Committee on Taxation comes down on sort of evaluating these. I don't think the book minimum tax may raise as much as was initially expected because of some changes that have occurred there. So will the difficulty of that continue to make that possible? When this has been done before, it's been repealed, book minimum tax in the past. So in the context of the full, you know, redoing the tax bill from 2017, will this be part of the mix there? And so that's why I'm saying that the potential moving parts here are significant. And I just, the bandwidth for Congress to be able to deal with this without a fully supportive administration helping with some of the backdrop on this. I mean, when I was working on tax reform, the administration, the Treasury Department, wasn't really engaged. And when you look back to the 86 Act, Treasury was all over it and very helpful. So it took a long time to develop these things. So depending on where, and the Trump administration obviously was all behind the 2017 Act.
Sure.
And I know that they worked very closely. So will Treasury be a part of the solution here? What will sort of the scoring be on some of these issues? And then how much, you know, fiscal space will there be to extend some of these provisions? I think those are kind of some of these overarching questions we don't know yet. But I know they're going to try, at least.
I mean, it is just a confluence of a whole number of issues that we covered between the massive budget issues that we have, the expiring of the provisions, the onset of Pillar 2, particularly the potential UTPR for U.S. companies, a lot to think about and look forward to here.
There's some good new smart people on finance and ways and means that are very interested in tackling these things. And so this is why the message has always been from PwC, build relationships with people on those committees, because, I mean, they're going to be doing a lot of work over the next couple of years.
So you mentioned this earlier in your introduction. I kind of want to end with this particular point. There's a more protectionism and, frankly, anti-big business themes that I've seen at any point in my lifetime on really both sides of the aisle, which is fascinating to me. Maybe the first question, and then I'll have one follow-up, but why, Chairman Camp, is the American corporation important to the United States?
Well, because, first of all, I mean, just on a basic level, jobs. And we need economic activity in the U.S. to continue to provide for people, for their families, to build the institutions, the hospitals, the schools, the churches that people who work in these companies often donate to or send their kids to or need health care from. So we need to have this, and the roads and the bridges and all of those things. And
sure.
So companies pay taxes. Now, some people say, well, they don't pay enough taxes, but they're a big part of this whole economic story that we need to tell. And I think the challenge for them to be is, why are they relevant? And I think what's happened is, when I was a kid, if you went to work for a big company, you were there till you were 65. And companies now, because of the competitiveness and the global economy we're in, many people are asked to retire with a package or maybe not at 50 or 52. So sort of the loyalty is not the same as it was when I was, you know, a younger person. And some of that's the dynamic in the world. So I think that's part of it. And
sure.
Then I think secondly, as companies have gone global, maybe they forget where they're from and, you know, all politics is local.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to continue to tell the story of how they're contributing not just to their bottom line, but to the livelihood or what product they're making. I remember when I was getting a medical treatment, the doctor said to me, "We have a miracle pill, and you're going to be okay." So the kind of innovation that U.S. companies have done in some of these spaces has led the world and has, you know, really improved people's lives. We have a very high standard of living here as well. So telling that story, but then making it granular, taking it right down to the communities and the specifics. And I think that's sometimes hard to do. It takes time to
sure.
do. But I think that's what companies need to do, business needs to do going forward.
Yeah, your point on allegiance is a good one. I mean, I'm almost 50. I've had pretty much one employer, which is PwC. I've been here for 25 years. I am the only one of my friends, you know, kind of counterparts at this age that have been at pretty much one company my entire career.
Right.
And I think that's a very interesting point. I mean, my grandfather worked for Westinghouse for 45 years.
Yes. Yes.
You know, like, I won't be working that long.
Yep.
So where, that's maybe the last question here, where can businesses turn to really protect the employee base and ensure pro-growth policies that benefit the country?
Well, I think they need to be engaged in the process. I mean, obviously, I was in the process, you know, as an elected official, so I think they really need to engage there, and particularly now when there's so much at stake in the next couple of years on tax. And I'm referring just to really tax policy
sure.
at this point. So, and I know many companies have built those relationships, and they've also done the internal work. They know what helps them. They know what hurts them. And to have sort of an understanding of where you are. And that's what a lot of companies ask us about, you and me about, as we travel around, like, what's doable, what's on the horizon. And they're vitally interested in what the future may hold here. So they can fashion their own future to some extent by their activity. You just can't expect it to happen, or that these, you know, policymakers will know the ins and outs of your business. I mean, you know, they have a lot coming at them. Not only do they need to know tax, they need to know every single issue
right
before the Congress. And so their bandwidth is very narrow. So to be able to have people that you can look to and, you know, trust and rely on for their take on how, what this means in the real world, not just because, you know, when you get into the political sort of analysis of tax policy, there are trade-offs that get made for political reasons.
Sure.
But they need to understand what that means in the real world.
Yeah, and that's a common theme as we're talking about tax policy, or get involved. And I think it's great advice. So, well, Chairman Camp, a fascinating conversation. You have an amazing career, and I appreciate you sharing your insights.
Thanks, great to be with you.
So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Chairman Dave Camp, PwC Senior Policy Advisor and former Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Global Leader. Stay tuned for another exciting edition of the Cross Border Tax Talks podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates, and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.